A little over 6 years ago, I began a series of radio programs over the mother station of KPFK, that is KPFA in Berkeley, which have been running ever since under the general title Way Beyond the West. And I think I may as well take off for listeners in Southern California by a short explanation of that title. It obviously had a double meaning. First of all, geographical, in that the west coast of the United States faces Asia across the Pacific. And in that sense, the Asian world is way beyond the West. The second reason for choosing this title was that the English word way is the nearest translation, perhaps, that we can make to a Chinese word, Dao. You know that's spelled T-A-O. I don't know why, because it's usually pronounced Dao. And the Dao means many things. Primarily, it means the way of nature, the way things go, the process of the universe. But it also means a way of life, a way of living in accordance with that process. And for example, in Japan, there are many crafts and arts, even sports, which have been influenced by Eastern philosophy, which are called ways in this sense. For example, you all know the word judo. Ju means gentle. Do is the Japanese way of pronouncing Dao, the gentle way. So Japanese also speak of fencing as kendo, the way of the sword. They speak of tea ceremony sometimes as chado, the way of tea. And in Japanese culture, there are all sorts of these dos. And they indicate not only simply the technique, our mastery of the technique of performing the given art, they also carry the implication that the art involves a way of life. Indeed, in almost the ancient Western medieval sense, every art is a mystery. One used to speak, you see, of the mystery of being a goldsmith, the mystery of being a mason, stonemason, the mystery of being a carpenter. And that strikes us probably as extraordinarily peculiar terminology. But the meaning of it was that every man's vocation in life, what the Indians call one's svadharma, which means approximately one's own function, one's own calling. Every vocation, in other words, is also a way of initiation, into the mystery of life, having somewhat a sort of religious function. So that the way is then the Tao in this title, Way Beyond the West. The way of deeper understanding, or something like that. But why do I say beyond the West, then, in that case? And the reason is that I think that we have not only obviously on the surface here lost the idea that our occupations are vocations. Oh no, not everybody has. But to a very large extent, our idea of an occupation is a way of making money. And we make a very, very destructive division between work and play. We spend 8 hours or whatever it may be at work in order to earn the money to enjoy ourselves in the other 8 hours. And that is a perfectly ridiculous way of living. It's much better to be very poor indeed than to do something so stupid as boring yourself and wasting yourself for 8 hours in order to be able to enjoy yourself the other 8 hours. And the result of this, when you get this fantastic division between work and play, is that work becomes drudgery and play becomes empty. We are speaking of a conception of life, in other words, where work and play should in a way be identical. And it's interesting that Hindus, when they speak of the creation of the universe, don't call it the work of God. They call it the play of God, the Vishnu Lila, Lila meaning play. And they look upon the whole manifestation of all universes as a play, as a sport, as a kind of dance. Lila perhaps being somewhat related to our word lilt. In this superficial sense, then, we have in the West tended to lose the idea of our work, our profession, being a way in that sense. And also, furthermore, our religions tend very much to lose sight of what is meant by Dao or way in Chinese, because to a very large extent, Western religion, Christianity, or in what we might call its standard brand forms, does not quite fulfill the function that things like Buddhism and Vedanta, which is the central doctrine of Hinduism, and Taoism fulfill in Asian society. Now, mind you, these ways of I'm talking about in Asia are not followed by an enormous number of people, except in a kind of nominal, superficial way. And I'm not trying to make any vast comparisons between Asian society and Western society, and saying that the total Asian way of life is superior to ours. I don't think it is, but I don't think it's necessarily inferior either. It's just different. But the fact remains that there is an aspect of Asian religion and Asian philosophy which is very subdued in Western religion and Western philosophy. So that you might say that a way in Asia, in the sense of the Chinese Dao, is something that does not quite exist in the West in any recognized form. It does exist, yes. It exists unofficially, it exists occasionally. But it's never clearly recognized. So I want to devote this first program to going quite thoroughly into what are these ways. Because this program is mainly going to be concerned with discussing the impact upon the West of these profounder aspects of the life and thought of Asia. Now, when we get introduced to some such subject, say, as Buddhism, or Vedanta, or Taoism, or Confucianism, we usually get introduced to it as a form of religion. We may have read books on comparative religion, wherein these phenomena are classed together with Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and so on. And this is really very misleading. It's almost as misleading as if you were to get a textbook on botany, on flowers, and suddenly come across a few chapters on birds. And you would think this was a rather odd classification. Well, if you know anything very much about these forms of Asian spirituality, you get the same kind of a funny shock in seeing them classed in the same type of thing as Christianity or Judaism. This is not to say, you see, that they are superior to Christianity and Judaism. They're different. They have different functions. And when we class them together as all various forms of religion, then a discussion arises as to which is the best religion for everybody, or the best one for you or for me. But I think the difference is much more subtle than that. And I can approach it best by saying that in the West, we have primarily three forms of wisdom: religion, philosophy, and science. And a way, a Dao, in the Asian sense, is neither. First of all, it seems to me that a religion from the Latin root religare, means a rule of life. Because religare means to bind oneself to something, to bind, as when we use the word religion in a very, very correct sense, we say of a person who has become a monk or a nun, that they have gone into religion, and that means that they have accepted a rule of life involving certain vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and other things as well. And the rule of life which constitutes a religion seems to me to consist of three things. A creed, first of all, which is a system of ideas about man and the universe and God, which are revealed ideas, and one believes in these ideas, one puts faith in them. And the great Asian ways that I'm speaking of do not, strictly speaking, have any creeds. They do not involve belief. That is to say, they do not involve committing oneself to certain positive opinions about life. Almost on the contrary, they abandon ideas and opinions because what they are concerned with is not ideas, not theories, but experience. Experience in the sense almost of sensuous experience, as when they say, you drink water and know for yourself that it is cold. So it is knowledge rather than faith that they are concerned with. Faith I'm using here in the sense of belief rather than the sense of trust. Because very often it seems to me that faith and belief could be opposed in the sense that belief from the Anglo-Saxon root leaf, which means to wish, is the fervent hope that certain things are true. Whereas I rather feel faith is an openness of attitude, a readiness to accept the truth whatever it may turn out to be. A commitment of oneself to life, to the universe, to one's own nature as it is, in the realization that we really have no alternative but to do that. It's like when you get in the water to swim, you have to trust yourself to the water. If you tighten your muscles and cling to the water, you'll sink fast. And next, it seems to me that a religion, besides having a creed, has a code. That is to say, a system of ethical and moral principles which one abides by, because these are revealed as expressing in terms of human conduct the nature and will of the divine. And these Eastern ways do not have a code in that sense. One often speaks of the moral code of Buddhism, but this is a little inexact. What is involved here is not any attempt to make man in accord with the nature of God or the will of God, but rather to suggest certain principles of action which are conducive to the discovery of the experience which lies at the heart and the root of Buddhism. Thirdly, religion seems to me to include a cult, a system of symbols and rites and ceremonials which in a certain way symbolically integrate the worshipper with the Godhead. And although there are rites and forms of not so much worship as thanksgiving in Buddhism and Hinduism, they are not regarded as very essential. They are not essential in the same way, for example, that Catholicism regards the rite of the Mass as essential. So, all in all, it would be difficult to say that Buddhism or Vedanta or Taoism are religions if Christianity or Judaism is what we mean by a religion. I don't want to dogmatize about the meaning of this word. But this is the way I use the word. I use the word religion to mean, in short, a rule of life which has as its function the integration of a community, the binding together of a community, when one becomes a Jew, when one becomes a Christian, what you do essentially is you join a society, you join a community. And in a way, you could say the function of a religion is what is called in Sanskrit loka sangraha, that means the upholding of the world, the upholding of the order of the community. For example, every community must have rules. We must have rules of language in order to be able to communicate with each other. We must agree that we are going to use the word a cloud as distinct from yun in Chinese. That's the noise they make when they mean cloud. We say cloud, which is the right noise. It doesn't matter, so long as the community in question agrees. And this is what we call a convention. Same way we agree by convention to drive on the right side of the road. So every community needs a system of conventions, and it seems to me that what religion originally provided was, as it were, a divinely sanctioned system of conventions under which the community lives. Now, the function of Buddhism is not so much to create a community. The function of Confucianism is to create a community and to lay down rules and conventions for a community. Parts of Hinduism, what one calls the caste system, the laws of Manu, they are concerned with laying down the rules for a community. But things like Vedanta and Buddhism and Taoism have almost the opposite function, which is to liberate the mind of man from enchantment by social convention. It isn't a revolution against social convention. It is perceiving that the rules of society are only conventional. That, in other words, the rules of a society, of language, of thought, of conduct, are not identical with the laws of God, or, if you want to say, the laws of nature, the processes of nature. We know perfectly well, for example, that it's very convenient to agree upon lines of latitude and longitude so that we can establish positions on the face of the globe. But we certainly jolly well know that when you cross the equator, you're not going to trip over a wire. It's an imaginary line. It isn't really there. Well, so in the same way, all sorts of things that we believe to be almost really existing. Time, you know, past and future. They exist only conventionally. And a person who lives for the future, who, in other words, like most of us, makes his happiness always dependent on what is coming in the future, is living in an illusion. He has confused a convention with a reality, because, as even our own proverb says, tomorrow never comes. And so one of the functions of a way, a Tao, is to deliver human beings from what Whitehead called misplaced concreteness, from confusing convention with reality, from confusing the laws of society with the actualities of the concrete, real world. In this sense, then, it is a way of liberation from social convention. So, in the same way also that these ways are not religion, they are not philosophy in our sense. Because philosophy, as we know it academically in the West, consists of a primarily verbal activity, constructing ideas, speculations about man and his life, about the nature of knowledge, the nature of being, the problems of ethics and aesthetics. And, of course, more recently, philosophy has not concerned itself so much with these things. Modern analytical philosophy is more concerned with the logical structure of ideas. And it is fundamentally, we might say, anti-metaphysical, because it feels that a great many metaphysical ideas are simply the result of linguistic and logical confusions. But by and large, you see, philosophy is concerned with ideas and their expression in words. In other words, with the building up of a purely intellectual structure. That is philosophy as we know it, the academic kind of philosophy. And here again, these Eastern ways are not philosophy. They are, just as they are not concerned with beliefs, they are not concerned with intellectual theories, except in a purely secondary way. The heart, the core of things like Buddhism and Vedanta, is a transformation of man's consciousness. Something like we might call in the West mystical experience. I don't like the word mystical because it often has very, very weird connotations. And one might speak more strictly of metaphysical experience. But even here, I don't really like that. I like something much more solid. The experience they're concerned with is very concrete. It's not anything abstract, because abstract things belong to the realm of theory. The transformation of consciousness which they're talking about is almost, you might say, a new way of using one's senses. And thus, it isn't at all wishy-washy, it isn't at all misty, if the word mysticism has any associations with mist. And so then again, just as this sort of thing is not religion and not philosophy, it is also not quite science. Although, in some respects, it's very close to science. The scientist, you see, is very often a man of real faith. A great, honest scientist is a person who says, I want to know what this world really is. I don't want to be bamboozled by theories and hypotheses. I want to face the facts. But, you see, the great interest, as it seems to me, of science is not actually the facts, not actually the concrete world, but the representation of the concrete world in terms of certain codes, the codes of numbers, of algebraical symbols, of formulae of various kinds, by which he represents the world in rather the same way that when we take a photograph of a person's face and reproduce it in the newspaper, and you look closely at a newspaper reproduction of a person's face, you'll see it's a lot of little dots. Well, you jolly well know a person's face isn't a lot of little dots, but you can so arrange little dots on paper that they will look like a face. In other words, that they represent a face in terms of dots. And so the function of science, part of the function of science, is to represent human experiences through our senses and through instruments in terms of linear symbols strung out in lines like mathematical equations. And to use these for predicting the future course of events. The practical function of science, in other words, is prediction, and therefore the control of the environment by the human being. And it's at this point, in a way, that a way of liberation departs from what we mean by science, because the focus of its interest is not so much on the future, on what will happen. The focus of its interest is on the present, because after all, it's surely clear, if you sort of open your eyes and don't let your mind interfere too much with what you are actually perceiving, that we only ever live in a present. It is always now. This may seem tautological and redundant to say something that everybody knows, but it really isn't something that everybody knows. Most of us judge the present by the little hairlines on our watches that mark the seconds. Well, a hairline is just as thin as you can get. It's no time at all. And we all get the feeling, you see, in our Western culture, that none of us have any time. Everybody says, oh, I'm so busy, I have no time for this, that, and the other thing. And this is because we are beguiled by time. We are beguiled by watches. We really believe that the present is a split second. But if you wake up and incidentally, waking up is what Buddhism means by Bodhi, or enlightenment. And the Buddha is the title of a man, not his name. It means the man who woke up, the awakened one. So all these ways are concerned with waking up, with coming to be dehypnotized, in the sense that every culture hypnotizes us. The moment a child comes into the world, people start talking or suggesting to it, and very soon persuade it that the world is the way this particular culture views it. Well, as we say, it ain't necessarily so. And time, again, is one of the great ways in which we are fooled. And we believe that the past and the future are, as it were, solid and longer than the present, more solid and longer than the present. In other words, we live in a sort of hourglass, with a big bulge at one end is the past, a big bulge at the other end is the future, and we're at the little neck between, and there we are, and we have no time. Whereas when one's vision becomes changed, you see that the truth of the matter is that we have an enormous present in which we live, and the purely abstract borders of this present are the past and the future. It's like a coin. A coin has two faces, but these faces are surfaces, and therefore they have a length and breadth, but no thickness, as surfaces. They are Euclidean and abstract, and the reality of the coin is the metal between the two surfaces. So in somewhat the same way, the reality of time is the present lying between the past and future, and the past and future are abstract. This, in other words, involves a sort of inversion of one's sense of time. And in this sense, then, these ways are not like science, that although they share something of the scientist's spirit of openness and non-dogmatism, they are not like science in that they are not primarily concerned with the future. That isn't to say that they reject the future, they don't care about it. Rather, one might put it in this way. There is no point in caring about the future, in making plans for the future, unless you are capable of living completely in the present. Because when your plans mature and the future comes and you can't live in the present, it was almost no use to make them. You can't enjoy what's happened. You are looking for something else over the shoulder of the event you have that has now become present. So then, in this first talk, I've tried to summarize rather negatively, by contrast with the three great forms of Western wisdom, what is this way beyond the West, which exists for a minority in Asia, and which I feel in the present climate of Western science and philosophy and our great religious upheaval, our discontent with our own traditions, is of enormous interest and value to us. I must be very emphatic about this. I am not a sort of missionary from Buddhism or Zen Buddhism or Taoism to try and convert Western people to these things, as if you could join them and become a member. On the contrary, I am rather trying to see what happens when we integrate their ideas with ours and have a grand mixture, which is, when you don't like doing this sort of thing, you have a cuss word for it. This is called syncretism. American civilization is unavoidably a syncretism of cultures, of peoples, and all sorts of things, and this is simply going to happen. So that is the subject of Way Beyond the West.
If you would like to receive information on how to order a copy of this program and hundreds of others from the Pacifica Radio Archives, please send 50 cents in postage stamps to Pacifica Radio Archives, 5316 Venice Boulevard, Los Angeles, California, 90019. That's Pacifica Radio Archives, 5316 Venice Boulevard, Los Angeles, California, 90019. Or call area code 213-931-1625.